Current State on 90.5 WKAR. It's Thursday, and I'm glad you're here. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks again to the 6,500 individuals and families and more than 100 business sponsors who made donations to WKAR Radio in the last year. Thanks to your involvement and your support, content that informs, inspires, and engages has a home on the radio and on your mobile device and online, of course, as well. You make WKAR a great resource for Mid-Michigan. Thank you for your support. At the top of our program today, it's hardly the Eiffel Tower or the Golden Gate Bridge, but the three towering smokestacks that dominate the Lansing skyline south of downtown are undeniably a city landmark. The Eckert Power Station has generated electricity since the mid-1950s. But the plant is outliving its usefulness. The Lansing Board of Water and Light plans to take it offline in 2020. Officials are considering how to replace that power capacity and build even more in the coming years. Eckert generates about 30% of the utility's electricity. Late last year, the BWL created a citizen advisory committee to develop a so-called integrated resources plan to prepare for the region's future energy needs. My guest is the co-chairman of that committee. Steve Transeth is an attorney specializing in energy law. He's also a former member of the Michigan Public Service Commission. Steve, welcome to Current State.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be here.
Let's be clear about Eckert's place in the BWL universe here. I'm under the impression Eckert burns only coal.
That's correct.
That's correct. And it produces only electricity.
Yes.
Is that, and it's about 30% of BWL's total?
About a third, yes.
Oh, about a third. Okay. Yeah. Well, the Citizens Advisory Committee has held a series of public meetings here in the past month or thereabouts. Your most recent one was last night. Talk to us about what you're hearing from the public.
Well, it's been a very interesting process. It's we've just completed our fifth meeting last night. It actually culminating in what I would say is our simulation of information. They've been giving us a great deal of information, a file cabinet full of information that's going to have to be assimilated by the committee, and we're going to have to kind of weed through that to come up with our recommendations. We're now going to be entering into our deliberation period. We hope that we'll probably start sometime beginning in February. And we will start to put together what we hope will be solid recommendations for the board on how we're going to meet the need of not only Luzon Eckert, which is about a third, but two other facilities, the Eckerson as well as Bell River, which is down in the Detroit area, which the board is a part owner in, are also coal and are also going to probably be affected by this at some point, that will probably lose them probably in the next 10 to 15 years. So We really are losing about 80% of what is current power that the city of Lansing uses in the region.
So you add those other two in, that takes that all the way up to 80% of the electricity.
We are facing some very significant challenges going forward in terms of replacing fossil fuel with clean energy to meet not only what I think the citizens of Lansing are looking for, but also what's coming down from the federal and state government in terms of clean power requirements.
Now, Eckert goes offline in 2020. What about those other two that you just mentioned?
They have
mentioned?
Not been set yet for retirement, but clearly because they're coal-fired, we'll have to be looking not only at Eckerson, which is a solely owned Board of Water and Light facility, but Bell River, which is actually owned by Detroit Edison, but we're a part owner in, whether or not those facilities can be converted to gas or what can happen in regards to those. But most likely we have to be looking at and planning that we'll probably lose those two facilities as well at some time within the next 10 to 15 years.
Can you say, Steve, you're hearing one thing or one sentiment more often from the public than any other?
Well, I can't really say one sentiment, but without question, we just, Epic MRA just did an extensive survey of the citizens as well as through our four hearings. I would say there are really kind of three components. So they really want a balanced approach with these three kind of tenets, and they're going to kind of probably shape how our recommendations are going to look. They want to make sure it's affordability. City of Lansing, Board of Water and Light customers do. I know sometimes it's hard when they open up their bills, but we do enjoy some of the lowest rates in the state. They want reliability. They want to continue to make sure that when they flip those switch, the lights come on. And they're very concerned about the environmental and want to make sure that whatever we do, that we address those concerns and making sure we have clean energy. They want a balanced approach with those three. They want to make sure we address those environmental issues, but they want to make sure we do so in a way that's going to be affordable and reliable going forward.
Well, affordable and environmental, there's some built-in tension to
there
that.
There is absolutely, Mark. You're absolutely correct about that.
We know that we've heard for years that coal is abundant and therefore less expensive, but of course we pay an environmental and a health cost with there. You got a tightrope to walk here.
I think that without question, coal is off the table for now. Until technology or something comes up with some way to burn coal cleanly, which right now does not seem to be on the horizon, we have to be planning for a future that does not include coal burning facilities.
The elimination of coal from sources as a power generating source.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's a big challenge. I mean, as I was just mentioning here in the city of Lansing, the percentage of our energy is produced primarily from coal. Statewide, it's primarily from coal. So as you start moving away from that and start moving to other forms, that's a transition. I always like to equate this a little bit to how the telecom industry was 20 years ago. The way we generate, transmit, and use energy in the next 20 years is going to look so much different than it does today. And we are in the cusp of that. It's a very exciting time to be part of the energy industry.
I find it a fascinating discussion, to tell you the truth. And it's interestingly, it is dramatically on the front page of today's Lansing State Journal. This involves the end of coal-fired power at Michigan State University. So it can be done. I mean, obviously, MSU is a smaller community than what the Board of Water and Light serves, but it's kind of an indication of the future and of the fact that it can be done. Is that how you interpret this?
Absolutely. It's going to vary dependent on facility to facility. Unfortunately, the Eckert is so old. It's like you mentioned in your intro, about 60 years old. It isn't one of those plants that we can actually look to do in some kind of conversion. It's the plant that's going to have to come offline, and we've slated that to be 2020. What that future is going to look for other plants, we're going to have to see. Clearly, natural gas is one of the things. It's much cleaner, about 50% less than coal. It is a good bridge, potentially, to get us to the technologies of the future, which may be able to produce energy completely carbon-free. Those are the kind of things we're going to have to look at.
Are you closing in on a strategy? Is any kind of framework even beginning to emerge?
I can't really say that. Ask me back in a couple months, and I might be able to give you that. Our schedule is to have two meetings coming up, like probably in February. We hope to start to put together our recommendations in March, with recommendations to the board in May as to what we feel would be a solid plan going forward to integrate all of these issues for the board in the next. And we're not just looking for the next 4 years, but also over the next 20 years and where the board needs to be going.
We're talking about the Lansing Board of Water and Light's long-term energy strategy. Our guest is Steve Transeth. He's the co-chair of the BWL's Integrated Resources Plan Citizen Advisory Committee. He's also a former member of the Michigan Public Service Commission, which regulates the BWL and all public utilities in the state. How much has this discussion, Steve, been impacted by President Obama's Clean Power Plan? I mean, that's setting stricter limits on coal burning.
Just to make one quick correction, the Michigan Public Service Commission does not regulate the Board of Water and Light. We are independently owned municipal utility. So other than certain minor issues, the Public Service Commission only regulates the large, basically, consumers.
DTE and consumers?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
As for the current regulations that are coming down, it is going to be have a significant impact. We have to comply with those. And as those...
Did it change the discussion, though? Did the public show up at these public meetings aware of the Clean Power Plan? And did they comment on it?
Not per se. They never commented necessarily on the Clean Power Plan per se. except to say that we had a very large contingency of citizens coming forward saying they wanted to see cleaner energy being part of the equation. They want to, the committee, by the way, is about 9 members, very diverse. We have people from health, environment, energy, and there isn't any question that this is going to be a critical factor for us to make sure that we go forward, that part of this plan is going to make sure that we address the environmental and health issues that we face in generating electricity. We all have to understand, we all want our lights to come on. We don't, and if anything, we need our electricity probably more today than we've ever needed. It's one of the greatest engineering feats in the last 200 years of how we have electrified our world. But if we're going to continue to have those kind of resources available to us, we have to realize that there's also certain prices to be paid. And so, like I said, when I started, we're going to have to really balance those. We're going to have to balance the environmental issues along with the cost issues and the reliability issues, and somehow or another develop a plan that's going to go forward, that's going to try to meet all of those objectives.
Let's talk about the, let's assume that think in terms of a pie chart here, and let's assume 100%, let's talk about all of the coal that will no longer be burned here at some point in the future. How much of that generating capacity do you expect to be replaced by, say, natural gas? Will the majority of the coal that you're no longer burning, will the majority of the electricity that you're no longer getting from coal, will that be generated by natural gas in the future? It sounds like that's the case.
Well, you got to, as we talk about eliminating these coal, large coal facilities, you're talking about what they refer to as baseload generation. And that means that's the majority of the electricity we receive. These are the plants that produce large portions, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 of megawatts of energy. It is very difficult today, with today's technology, to be looking at some of the most clean energy, other than nuclear, but you have the primary ones we think of is like wind and solar. They currently do not have the ability to replace that kind of baseload generation. So as we, on the one hand, say we got to get rid of these coal facilities, on the other hand, we got to realize that these are our large baseload plants that somehow or another we have to replace with some type of energy, generation energy, that can produce those kind of volumes. And consequently, the only thing we really have available to us right now is natural gas.
State government, the legislature, and the governor are trying to hammer out an updated energy policy for the state of Michigan as
well. Right in the midst of it.
While you are having your conversation, how closely are you having to watch what emerges from the state capitol?
Very close, because this is the city of Lansing, and this is says a lot for its current management team of Dick Pelfrey and George Stosik. They've gotten ahead of the curve on this because part of that state plan that's just being produced, and we'll probably see that within the first quarter, they're talking about possibly getting this out and getting it passed. It includes a requirement of doing some kind of IRP or integrated resource planning for the state. So all of the utilities are going to have to be doing what the City of Lansing Board of Water and Light is doing at the present time.
A comment, please, about the place of renewables and just what you think the role of renewables will be at the Board of Water and Light.
Without question, as you may or may not know, we just announced a new solar facility. It's going to be the largest in the Midwest when it gets comes online. We have wind currently within our structures, not a lot, but a small amount. We also have current bio mass type of production out of the Granger facility. They produce, in total, will produce a small percentage as it stands right now, but without question, it is going to play a larger role as we go forward, and it's going to be an integral part of whatever piece of the puzzle that we put together in terms of meeting our needs.
Steve, we'd like to have you and maybe some other members from the committee back here to talk about this as you put together your recommendations.
We would be glad to.
And as this takes shape, it's a really interesting and important discussion. We've been talking about Michigan's and the Lansing area's energy future. In particular, what may happen as the result of the retirement of the Eckert Power Plant in Lansing in 2020. Steve Transeth is the co-chair of the BWL's Integrated Resources Plan Citizen Advisory Committee. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
And coming up on Current State, Michigan is home to thousands of white-tailed deer. The animal is so abundant, there's even an image of one on our state flag. Of course, some communities sanction deer harvests each year to curb overpopulation. This week, sharpshooters will be hunting deer in parts of Meridian Township, where cases of chronic wasting disease were detected last spring. We'll hear from the township's Parks and Land Management Coordinator and the former head of the Michigan Department of Natural Resources for their take. Coming up on Current State. An established and popular bluegrass duo from Traverse City will be performing one of its last concerts tomorrow night at the Hanna Community Center in East Lansing. Current State producer Katie Cook spoke with a member of the duo. Katie, who'd you talk to?
I spoke with Don Julin. He plays the mandolin with guitar player Billy Strings. They're an impressive duo. I actually really like the way they were described by John Sinkovics of Local Spins in West Michigan. He described them as playing sizzling bluegrass with sweat-drenched rock and roll vigor.
All right.
And after watching some of their videos, I'd have to agree. They've been playing and touring together quite a lot for the past 2 years, so we started by talking about that. You've been playing and touring together for the past 2 years. Do you have any favorite moments or shows from the last 2 years together?
Yeah, we did a week of shows with David Grisman and Del McCurry. That was really pretty fabulous. We played in New York, and Chicago, and Cleveland, and, you know, and those guys are such legends that, of course, every show was sold out. It was really fun.
Now, how long have you been a musician? Because you had some, you got started in jazz, is that right?
Well, I don't know about that. I'm kind of known for playing more jazz because, I don't know why. Maybe because there isn't much bluegrass around here. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I started playing in 1979.
Do you play other instruments besides the mandolin?
Yeah, but they're mostly mandolin-style instruments. Most of the bands that you see me in, you'll go, people will say, what is that you're playing? That's a cute little guitar. And it's not, you know, because most of the music I play, I don't play what looks like a mandolin. I do when I play with Billy, but, you know. So, yeah, I'm a mandolin player that has figured out how to play anything from reggae to heavy metal to jazz to country western to anything. You just take a mandolin and you plug it into an amplifier and you treat it like a guitar and it works.
Now, I'm curious about that, about how the mandolin relates to other stringed instruments. Is it something that somebody who is familiar with guitar could pick up and learn fairly easily, or how does it differ?
No, it's actually much closer to a violin.
Okay.
A violin player can pick up a mandolin and play music. A guitar player, not so much.
How many strings does it have, and are there different models that are in different keys?
Yeah, that's a good question. Traditionally, mandolins have 8 strings. It's 4 pairs of strings. So there's really only 4 pitches, like a violin, like 4 strings, but each one is doubled.
Okay.
To give you a little more volume. So sort of like string guitar, if you're familiar with that, or even a piano. If you look inside a piano, there's a series of, you know, maybe 3 strings for this A note, so the hammer hits 3 strings instead of just 1. And so mandolin is a double string instrument, and it is tuned exactly like a violin.
Okay.
So, and then in the same context as a violin, there's the bigger violin is called a viola, and then there's a cello, and then there's a bass. And mandolin has the same thing. There's different sized mandolins. Some would be called mandolas, or
right,
octave mandolins, or even mandocellos, which are pretty rare, but they do exist. So when they developed the mandolin, they were really thinking as a classical orchestral instrument, similar to a violin that you didn't bow, that you just played with a pick. So there's a whole family of mandolin instruments, just like there's a family of violin instruments.
And ukuleles, too, kind of have that same family, don't they?
I think they do. I don't know much about ukuleles. I'm probably the only musician in the world who doesn't know anything about ukuleles. But I really don't know much about them.
I'm speaking with Don Julin, a mandolin player and one half of the Traverse City bluegrass duo, Billy Strings and Don Julin. They will be performing at Friday night's 10-pound fiddle concert at the Hanna Community Center, and it will be one of their last concerts together. So, Don, we're going to listen to a little bit of your solo in Little Maggie. This song is on your 2014 live album called Fiddle Tune X. This might seem like a funny question, but I wonder how it feels to play an instrument that well. Like, how do you feel when you play?
When I'm playing mandolin, I'm probably the most comfortable and most content I am of any moment of the day. It's my favorite part.
How much improvisation do you do on stage at a show? Or are your solos... Are much of them improvised?
Yes. To a point. I'm like the one that you're referring to right now. Yeah, I certainly never attempted to repeat that.
Mm-hmm.
But we played that song every night. We played that song 700 times. And I never really thought about repeating any themes. Although, you know, it happens because you play it so many times.
Mm-hmm.
But much of, you know, I guess that's coming from a jazz background. A big part of jazz is improvisation. So I'm an improviser.
So you will be in Lansing Friday night and then Kalamazoo on Saturday. And are these going to be your last performances in Michigan as a duo?
These are our last performances anywhere as a duo at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You never know moving forward what could happen. But at this point, we're going our own separate ways. Billy is in Nashville and pursuing a solo career.
And what will you do next?
Same thing I've been doing for 30 years. Put together awesome bands and play around Michigan.
And you're a teacher too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I do teach mandolin. I teach at camps. I'm the author of two very successful mandolin books. And I'm currently working on building an online mandolin school.
I want to take us out with one more song from the Local Spins podcast recording. You guys played something called Albino Skunk, and I understand you wrote this.
I did write that one. I wrote that throughout the course of the last year.
Let's go, Don. You ready, boys?
One, two. Yeah, it's an original tune, and if there would have been a third Billy and Don album, it probably would have been on there.
Well, I wish you the best of luck.
All right, well, thanks. You have a great day.
Thank you. You too, Don. For Current State, I'm Katie Cook.
Coming up on Current State, we will go to the top of Beaumont Tower and explore the bells that have been chiming out both music and the time since 1928. Jamie Paisley speaks with Professor Ray McClellan about some of the big bells at MSU and across Michigan.
The third heaviest carillon in the country is in Ann Arbor at Burton Tower, because their biggest bell is 12 tons. So we're talking about the original heavy metal music.
That and more after the break on Current State. Stay with us.
There's no drama queens or queen bees around here. I'm not as lucky as the cool kids with the hybrid cars, or the close friends or the movie stars, but I can live with everything I'm not. And I'm still waiting for reality to come and give me life. So until then, I'll sit tight right here. Yeah, right here is where.
That's local singer-songwriter Taylor Taylor performing the song right here in Studio S last summer on a Live Music Friday. Quite a voice for someone not yet out of high school. Tomorrow we welcome back Donnie Brown, former Verve Pipe drummer, for a solo set of music from his new EP for another Live Music Friday here on Current State. We hope you can join us. Deer hunting season's been over for nearly a month now, but this week a few hunters are scouting for whitetails in Meridian Township. The kills won't be for sport, but instead for survival. Current State's Kevin Lavery is here to explain why the need for this late-season deer harvest, Kevin.
Mark, you may recall last spring, state wildlife officials detected a few cases of chronic wasting disease in the deer herd in Meridian Township. So the township wants to get out ahead of this problem. They've contracted with a select group of sharpshooters to hunt deer on some private land. Now, deer management efforts are controversial in some places. To learn more about the background of this, I spoke with Jane Greenway. She is the Parks and Land Management Coordinator for Meridian Township. She says the township began its regular seasonal deer harvest in 2011 as a population control method.
And thank goodness we did, because lo and behold, last May, sadly, chronic wasting disease was discovered in Meridian Township. And it seems to be a very complicated disease, but I guess from a land management standpoint, I'm glad that we had a plan in place to try to get ahead of this overpopulation. And it continues to be a success. And I'm really proud of Meridian Township and the residents for being in such support of something that was a little bit revolutionary at the time and still is, you know, hunting in neighborhoods in a relatively densely populated suburb.
And a clarification, Jane, this is archery, this is not firearms.
No, when we began planning our program, we conducted surveys, we held township hall meetings, and we talked about that. And the general public is just not hip to hearing gunshots. They just aren't. Our hunters do use crossbows, and crossbows can go far, but they are in tree stands shooting down. Now this year, because of the chronic wasting disease, hunters were not allowed to use bait. And so there are no piles of carrots around, nothing like that. They had to, you know, do the true hunt. And so as a result, 54 deer were harvested. Well, that's still, you know, 108 or so, maybe less next year. So it's important and it's valuable. But the no baiting thing sure did change how many deer we were able to harvest.
Just as the name suggests, chronic wasting disease is a degenerative condition that attacks a deer's central nervous system. Affected animals begin to behave abnormally, lose body functions, and eventually become emaciated, literally wasting away.
It's fatal. It's always fatal. But they have it for 2 or 3 years before those significant signs develop, and that's what makes it so elusive or so difficult to control.
Dr. Howard Tanner lives in Meridian Township, and he knows a thing or two about deer. Tanner once served at the helm of the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. He's best known as the father of Michigan's salmon fishing industry. But over a decade ago, Tanner also led the state's Chronic Wasting Disease Task Force, appointed by then-Governor Jennifer Granholm. Tanner gets his share of deer meandering through his backyard, which borders a golf course. But he's not worried about the effects of close contact. Fortunately, chronic wasting disease is not transmittable to humans.
I think that's a point that we ought to emphasize. There's no record of deer or elk transmission to people. However, the worry is that the mad cow disease, which was in England, and which a similar or related organism was transmitted to people, and some 30 people died and so on. And I have two sons that hunt elk and deer in Colorado, and every time they kill an animal, it's taken in to be inspected. And over several years, they've had one positive animal. So it decimates the deer herd. The deer herd is a very valuable asset to the state of Michigan. Our deer season brings in certain, in terms of economic activity, some several billion dollars. And we really don't want to deal with a herd that has some sick individuals in it. And states, one after the other, have encountered it and tried to control it. We presumably get a little better at it, but we haven't been successful.
This week, Meridian Township is trying again to combat the disease. Again, Parks and Land Management Coordinator Jane Greenway.
This week, sharpshooters will return to portions of the township, and the part that they're focusing on is within a 2-mile radius of where the deer with CWD were found. And that is something that is paid for and supported by the Department of Natural Resources. So that's a bit different. That is using firearms with silencers. These are not just anybody, though. These are professionals who have been in the service and in most instances and really know what they're doing. They are using bait. Our experience with this has been nothing but positive. We haven't had any complaints about the hunting. We haven't had any complaints about the sharpshooters. People describe it as hearing like two boards being clapped together in the backyard.
But there are other places in our state where that's not been the case. As an example, there is a lawsuit right now going on in Ann Arbor, and I need to say that these are different circumstances, what's happening in Ann Arbor. This is not a situation where the herd is diseased with chronic wasting disease, but there is a lawsuit to prevent local municipal officials from conducting their own type of a hunt. What do you know about that?
Yes, I think that when we first began, there were questions, which is good. It's good to be skeptical about these things. But I think that in our community, we have so many experts for the state of Michigan and Michigan State University, and it seemed, I was quite shocked. I thought this would never happen in a place like Ann Arbor or Okemos. I just didn't think it would, it doesn't seem like a hunting kind of a place, what we think of, our perception. And it really, I want to say it went off without a hitch. I think that we've worked so closely in hand with our wildlife biologists, and no one's approaching this from an emotional level of these are God's creatures and we're killing them. It's a lot of people seem to have gotten far past that and are really looking at this in terms of conservation and what are the wildlife managers saying? I mean, what are they finding? What are their population studies telling us? But Meridian Township has so many more deer than Ann Arbor. And I'm not trying to minimize their issues because I have no doubt that there's herds in certain areas of the city that are really affecting people. And that's an issue. But to me, honestly, it's just kind of funny how few they have compared to up in Meridian. It's, you cannot drive around here ever without seeing deer. Lucky for Ann Arbor, their problem isn't as bad as ours. Maybe it is a good thing that they're getting ahead of it now. Maybe that's the smartest thing they could do before it gets out of control. Maybe we could learn a lesson from Ann Arbor.
Former DNR Chief Howard Tanner concedes deer are often an unwelcome pest that trample neighborhood gardens and a safety hazard that cause thousands of vehicle accidents in Michigan every year. But he's not completely sold on Meridian Township's solution.
Hunting in the city or in a suburb is not the way to thin an urban deer population. And believe me, these deer get very, very urban. And you see them in the heart of East Lansing. And they developed a program for trapping them, live trapping them. They would take them and they euthanize them and give them to a a processing plant who would then give them to the poor for food. And it worked quite well until a lawsuit was brought and said that they didn't want the Bambi cleared out. Midland up in the Saginaw Valley had a similar one while I was director, and this is humorous, this is a little careful subject here, but we had a program going where we were thinning them with bow and arrow hunters, and it went quite well for a while until the Humane Society got in. And I say this in jest, the president of the Michigan Humane Society wrote a letter to the press. And when he said, this is no way to control the deer, you should give the male deer a vasectomy. Now, we said, okay, bring them in and we'll take care of them. And that didn't work very well. So.
We're talking with Jane Greenway, the Parks and Land Management Coordinator for Meridian Township. Looking at the 10,000-mile view, Jane, in terms of urban development, setting aside green spaces, encroachment in terms of wildlife and people interacting together, how do we try to strike a balance in this community so that one species or another, human or deer, are not really on top of each other?
It is such a challenge, and I think that a lot of people say they were here first, their nature. But It's almost like it's such a mess now, the ecological balance that we now have to deal with it. And in particular, for me, we have almost 2,000 acres of parks and land preserves, natural areas, in other words, to manage. Well, those weren't always owned by the government. It used to be someone owned it and probably had a hunter out there, maybe, if it was a large property. And then we come into town and buy it, and then what? And then there's a lot of deer. So it somehow is always the government's responsibility to handle these things and to try to do it in a humane manner. And that's what we've tried to do, is have things be very safe. We have, we test our hunters' proficiency. We do extensive background checks. So these aren't just anybody. It's they're certified hunters. And we are just trying to do the best we can to balance it all. We have people clamoring for wildflowers and that the deer are eating all the wildflowers, and what are you going to do about that? And they're spreading invasive. So everyone has their interest. And, and fair enough, some people's are basically a nature preserve for the animals, but it's a very complicated system. And we're constantly trying to, I think, tweak something that we've already tweaked too much. But for the people who live along the river, I mean, it's like you're never not going to have deer and wildlife here. The deer obviously like it here more than they do, up north. And you always hear that there's not as many deer in the Upper Peninsula and places like that. Well, as it turns out, they're like these urban animals almost. They love grass. They love hostas, ewes. They have the river. I mean, you can't beat it. It's better than the woods.
There's food here, too, that's probably a little more available than in the woods.
Yes, and sadly, people still feed them. And I think that their hearts are probably in the right place because they see these poor, sad deer standing in the snow. But it is, it is never a good idea to feed the deer. And so we are in the process of getting an ordinance going for that, too, where you can only feed songbirds.
This week, we have sharpshooters going out to thin the herd, to try to reduce the incidence of chronic wasting disease. We should stress again that this is not a disease that is transmittable to humans, but is there any risk of any type of negative consequence with close contact between deer and humans?
Well, we get funny stories about these people trying to go into their garages and these deer standing in their driveways and snorting at them, or, these bucks kind of getting aggressive with their dogs. But not really. Those reports are pretty few and far between. I think that the poor deer have more to worry about than we do with them.
Jane Greenway is the Parks and Land Management Coordinator from Meridian Township. We've been talking about this week's planned deer harvest to mitigate the effects of chronic wasting disease in the area. Jane, thank you.
Thank you so much.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Beaumont Tower has been a part of the Michigan State University landscape since 1928. And Current State's Jamie Paisley went to the very top of the tower to inspect the series of bells up there, part of an instrument called a carillon. I hope you're not afraid of heights, Jamie.
Well, actually, I am a little bit. And
it's
it
a little bit of a climb.
Exactly. And those last set of stairs look very steep, and even more so when you're trying to keep a microphone in your hand as well. But that's all in a day's work for Professor Ray McClellan, the MSU carillonner since 1997. And although Ray has been the carillonner for nearly 20 years, he still thinks many folks don't know that there's often a musician up there.
I'm afraid that probably a lot of people, they hear the carillon, they just probably think it's a computer playing. Now, the computer does play MSU Shadows every day just before 5 o'clock. But, of course, when it's sounding the quarter hour, quarter, half hour, three-quarter, and full hour, it's a computer playing. I don't want people to think that somebody's actually up sitting up here every 15 minutes and playing the bells. But actually, people ask me that question, so obviously some people think that. But most of the time, when you hear music playing, it's going to be a live person.
We're here at the bottom of Beaumont Tower, and it is a fairly crisp day, let's say. And I know that there's a heater in the bells themselves at the carillon, but is there ever any time where it's unsafe to play that you're fearing that it might crack?
It's not that it's unsafe to play. It may be bad for the bells. So yeah, ice can form on the wires. And so I tell my students, every time you go up to play, make sure you check the batons. And if something won't move, don't force it. Just lightly work with it, because that's a very bad thing to try. If we break a wire, then we're sunk until you can get it repaired. So when I play, the clappers inside the bell are playing. But when the automatic system plays, it's the hammers on the outside of the bells. And so not all the bells have those hammers. 27 bells have the hammers, and then all 49 bells have clappers that we play. So when the computer plays, as it's playing the half hour, three-quarter hour, it's the computer doing that. And it's playing the hammers on the outside of the bells.
You have a variety of students that come, and not all of them are MSU students. Could you talk about the process, about how the different sort of community members that also come in to take lessons?
Yes, so any student at MSU can take carillon lessons. They just have to have some keyboard experience and be able to read basic music. And they can come and email me or call me and ask if they'd like to audition, and it's an easy audition. But if they're really interested in playing, they certainly can. And I've got a couple of students this semester who are definitely not musicians, but they're really interested in playing the carillon. So I try to work with them and see what we can do. But I also have students who come through the Community Music School. And the Community Music School is sort of an off-branch of the College of Music. So you can enroll there for very inexpensively to take lessons. And you don't have to be a university student. You can be anybody from the community, and you can take lessons that way, too.
There's an interesting technique. As you talk about the students that come, they have to have keyboard experience. But there's not really a whole lot of five-finger technique when you're dealing with keyboard. It's a very different sort of playing mechanism that you have.
Yeah, so just because I say you have to have piano experience or keyboard experience doesn't mean you have to be able to play with your fingers. You're actually playing with your lightly closed fists. And so you're hitting, I don't like to use the word banging, but you're hitting the keys and also playing with your feet. And so most of the time we're playing single notes with each hand, but sometimes we open our hands to play chords. And there's all different kinds of techniques to play chords, broken and open chords and stuff like that. And then your feet, you play with your both feet. And so actually we can get a very full sound on the carillon.
And how many days of the week are you actually on campus?
I teach on Tuesdays, and I play at noon, and I teach all day. And basically, I'm just here one day a week. And of course, the students have to be able to come here to practice, because there's only one place to practice. That's the ground floor of Beaumont Tower, where we have a practice clavier, practice carillon. And so you can't practice at home. You have to come here to practice. So we have to make a schedule and let people sign up for their time to come to practice here.
My name is Yi Ting, and we're standing at the Beaumont Tower, where the carillon sits.
Yi Ting Chua is one of the carillon students of Professor Ray McClellan.
I've been taking lessons for 4 years now, I believe.
But are you a music student?
No, I'm actually a criminal justice major. The first time I came across this was my senior year here, and I wander upon here where the doors open, and then visitors are invited to go upstairs and actually watch Ray play. So I went up there and realized, wow, this is really cool. And then given that I have previous piano experience, so I decided to take lessons.
We're not at the top of Beaumont Tower right now. Where are we?
We are on the first floor, and basically the ground floor when you enter. And you see there's a practice carillon that resembles what it's actually upstairs, but it's not attached to any bells. It's so that students can practice down here.
If it's not attached to any bells, what is the sound that comes out of it then?
I believe it comes out from a computer program that imitates what it would sound like when the bells are playing upstairs.
When are you allowed to then go upstairs to play the normal carillon?
So we do go upstairs at times during lessons to prepare ourselves for the recital, which is at the end of semesters. All the students will gather together and then play upstairs.
Do you want to play a little bit?
Yes.
That's the sound of the practice carillon instrument at Beaumont Tower on the MSU campus, as played by Yi-Ting Chua, criminal justice grad student who also takes carillon lessons from Professor Ray McClelland. Yi-Ting then leads me up to look at the regular carillon, which looks a lot like an old-fashioned weaver's loom, with a row of cables heading straight up to the ceiling, at which point I'm led to yet another set of steps.
Oh, we're going up there?
Yeah.
Oh, cow, okay. It's really cold. Wow, these are steep. And you can't really see a whole lot either. Yes, there's light now. Wow, these are massive. There is another way that other people can see the bells themselves and the instrument, yes?
As far as seeing the bells,
coming into Beaumont Town.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I just wanted to mention that Beaumont is played on weekdays at noon, and this semester it'll be Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday because our regular Wednesday person is traveling. So, but it's open on Tuesdays when I play. Tuesdays at noon, we open it up to the public to come upstairs, and people can come up and watch me play, and then they can take a look at the bells and see how it works and ask me questions between pieces. But the other days of the week it's played, but it may or may not be open because you have to have a guard at the bottom of the tower.
Since you're not based in East Lansing, are there other carillons that you are responsible for?
No, this is the only carillon I'm the official carilloner for, but in the state of Michigan, we have now, I think, 14 carillons, probably almost more than most states. Texas may have as many, and maybe for some reason out east, the carillons started. The art of carillon actually started in the Netherlands, now the Netherlands and Belgium and northern France. And that art expanded, especially here after World War II, because it takes so much money to build a tower and have these bells. So the art in North America has really continued, especially after World War II. However, our carillon was, the tower was built and the bells were installed and finished in 1928, and it was dedicated in 1929. And so there were some carillons during the time when the Rolling Twenties, when there was a lot of money rolling out around before the crash. So there's a lot of carillons from that period. But in Michigan, we have 14. There's two in this area. There's one in a church in Lansing, Century United Methodist Church, right next to the Capitol building. Grand Valley State University has one on each of their campuses, one in Allendale and one in Grand Rapids. And then there's two in Ann Arbor, one on Central and one on North Campus. But I should say, the biggest carillon in the world that is the biggest in the number of bells is in Bloomfield Hills at the Kirk in the Hills. They have 77 bells. So no other carillon has that many bells. And the third heaviest carillon in the country is in Ann Arbor at Burton Tower, because their biggest bell is 12 tons. So we're talking about the original heavy metal music.
So then what are the size of the bells that we have upstairs?
So we go anywhere from 2.5 tons up to the smallest bell is 15 pounds. And it works perfectly for our size of tower. We're not a huge tall tower. We're about 104 feet tall, I believe it is. And we have the 49 bells, and they're all inside a chamber. So the sounds all mix nicely, and then the sounds come down outside through the louvered. There's little louvers up there, and the sound mixes nicely.
Little what? What
louvers. Is that? So like, well, they don't open and close like shades or anything, but they're louvers, so the sound is cast down almost straight down, so it doesn't travel a long ways. So in the summertime, if you were to come and listen to our summer recitals, we have all through the a month of July, Wednesdays evenings in July at 6 o'clock. Now we haven't scheduled all of our recitalists yet, but we usually have them from all over the world. And so people sit outside when it's so nice outside on the green grass and under the trees. Some bring their blankets and some bring gourmet picnics. And they're out there enjoying the time while the Caroline's playing.
For those that don't want to come out in mid-January and sit in the snow, they can come in the summer.
That's right. Yeah, it's pretty cold outside, but it's nice when you can come inside and listen, watch, and play when I play on Tuesdays.
You can find more information about the Beaumont Tower Carillon at tour.msu.edu. And if you're interested in taking lessons yourself from Professor Ray McClelland at the Beaumont Carillon through the Community Music School, you can visit cms.msu.edu. For Current State and High Above the Banks of the Red Cedar, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow, learn about legislation making its way through the state legislature that aims to make life better and more stable for kids in Michigan's foster care system. State Senator Rick Jones of Grand Ledge and Matt Gillard from Michigan's Children join me. Today, we conclude Current State's third year of programs. Many thanks to you, our listeners and supporters, for all the support and for listening. Have a great day. See you on Live Music Friday with Donnie Brown here on Current State.